We ask that you not come back to the station. Headquarters obliged. I had to personally reconstruct his, among other things, he was, he had an operational fund shortage of 70,000 piastres. Don't ask me what that was in dollars. I don't remember. I think it was probably
$5,000.
Between $5,000 and $10,000.
Yeah,
there was a shortage in his operational fund. He could not account for this money. I went up to Tainan and I got his accounts, all of his papers and his bag of receipts. He must have had receipts that were a year old. He had stuffed in some envelopes up there. And I personally, it took me a day to do it. Did 2 days to do it. Reconstructed this whole thing, and I found all but about 5,000 piastres of his money.
He just was not handling his accounts properly.
He was not handling
it wasn't
his
that
accounts.
he wasn't handling the money properly.
He wasn't dishonest about
okay.
it. He was just not able to
couldn't handle the money.
Put it all together.
And so, obviously, it wasn't a question of time, because if he had spent the time with it, he probably could have done it.
Yeah.
Okay. It was the pressure.
Okay, another. A case which never came into existence, but if it had, it would have been taken care of very quickly. I had an absolute prohibition in field operations activities towards conducting or sanctioning or witnessing without intervention, any acts of torture.
And
if in any way an officer had come to my attention that was involved in such an activity,
mm-hmm.
He would have been
what about
sent home
turning the blind eye?
Within less than 24 hours, he would be on his way to.
Was there ever a case where it happened?
There was no such case. Possibly because the reports never got to me.
Okay.
However, just as an aside at this point, torture of Viet Cong prisoners was entirely unnecessary. Two reasons. One, the hardcore would never talk no matter what they did.
That's true.
The French found this out. And the French are given to torture. I mean, the Day of the Jackal is only fiction in certain
yeah.
respects.
Well, I've read about Algiers.
Yeah, Algiers, Vietnam.
Yeah.
Secondly, you get all the information you want from the people that as soon as they realize that you're not going to kick their teeth in, they just pop. They just sing like birds. Which means most of them. Now, in the field operations,
mm-hmm.
we ran three major activities, which I did not organize them. The activities were all in existence, but what I did do, if you will, was to clean up the act.
Okay.
To sharpen the targets. To bureaucratize, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The three programs were, first of all, the informant program, police special branch informants. All counterinsurgency depends, in the first instance, on informants. And without them, you're dead. With them, you can do all sorts of marvelous things. This is something that can only be a local operation. Family affair, it's a few piastres change hands, it's a gift, it's this, it's that. The second major program was so-called PICs,
okay.
Province Interrogation Centers.
Okay.
We built them.
Beginning in 65?
Beginning in 65. Tucker had about, I would say, maybe as many as 10 built by the time we got there. Maybe 8.
Okay.
And we had 44 of them by the time we built those as quickly as we could.
Well, we'll go back and go over each of the three a little bit more, but
yeah.
You might as well get
and then the third major program was the Under the picks, there's a subcategory known as the Chew Boys.
Very good.
Being defectors.
Okay.
Not only prisoners, but also the defectors. The interrogation program, let's call it that. Okay. First is the informant program, the second is the interrogation program, and the third is the agent penetration.
Okay, so Chu Hoy comes under PICS, and then three is penetration. Which is the turning of Vietnamese Viet Cong into your agents.
Recruitment in place of Viet Cong, yes.
Well, I could tell you right now, I could spend a day on each one of these, probably asking you questions. That's how interested I am.
I could talk more than a day on each one.
Okay, and if you would be willing to spend some time, you know, I would be willing to listen and record and ask what I think might be some provocative questions and interesting.
These were the police field operations.
Especially the penetration is the one that I think interests me the most, because I've heard from some of the Special Forces guys that I worked with that there were probably, well, one guy said 50 to 80 programs involved all throughout plan numbers from 1 through 80 involved with penetration projects. And I've heard of some, some very interesting methods of doing it. And it's something that I always wanted to hear about from an expert. So.
Well, we had over several hundred, I suppose. Most of them low level. Occasionally you get something a little bit better. Medium-sized fish rather than,
But these things have to be cultivated over years anyway,
assume. Well, not in the place, not in the counterinsurgency environment.
Because the money is there to be made.
It's either quickly or not at all.
Really?
They had some, a unilateral operations branch in the station, which went after some very high-level, very sophisticated type of penetration operations. But my shop had nothing to do with it.
Was that the Frank Snett branch? He always talked about having somebody high up in Cosvin or something like that.
I don't. Snett was years after me, as I recall.
Oh yes, he was. Yes.
And I don't. They had some people that they thought were in Cosvin.
Let me ask.
I've never read Snett's stuff. That's the thing.
It wouldn't be. I'm sure it wouldn't be news to you, but. Were there staff meetings in the station, for instance, weekly, where unilateral ops would get together with your branch, and all the branches would sit around a table, the division, the chief of each branch, and sit there, and everybody share information wouldn't trip over each other?
No. There'd be staff meetings. There'd be a regular weekly meeting.
Which everybody would attend, the chiefs of each of the branches would attend.
Okay. But an information meeting, coordination, this and that, personnel matters, problems. They're not going to share any operational stuff in those meetings, or relatively little. Some guy may have just scored a big success of some type and come in regularly.
I was just wondering how the station itself was run, if it was run traditionally the way any organization would be run, with open lines of communication and
it's compartmentation.
It is.
Still.
And that's, so only the chief of staff and his deputy would really be aware of everything that was going on.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, everybody else is. And that's what it is. Is that essentially how compartmentalization is defined?
Yeah.
Within a station, only the chief knows what's going on.
Well, no, not that so much as a person will be briefed or introduced or participate in a given activity or type of information. Only if he needs to know that information. For example, out in Tehran, at the time of the Berlin crisis, even today, I don't think the world knows how close we came to war with the USSR. Because Khrushchev laid right down the line, and Kennedy laid it right back to him.
Yeah.
And we were under instructions. We were instructions to seek out our GRU, the Russian military intelligence people. We were in, We received these. Let's see. First of all, we got an isolated message from the chief of station regarding movement of two paratroop divisions from Tbilisi down to, I guess, from Tashkent to Tbilisi.
Iranian paratroops.
Russian Soviet.
Okay.
And we had information. We had the plan of operations from Penkovsky. And what was going to be, these troops were for an airborne assault on Iran, securing of Iran within 24 hours of initiation of hostility. So we were under warning and stationed to be prepared to get out of there, and the Russian troops, the first thing that we might know of war is to see the parachutes coming down the sky. It was that close. We were under instruction to seek out our GRU counterparts and tell them, okay, things are pretty sticky right now, but we want you guys to know we're ready if you are. That's how close we were to.
So that's the GRU is, that's the Russian agents who are doing what you were doing.
That's Russian military intelligence officers in their embassy.
No.
It's their military attaches and some of their other people.
Yeah, okay.
And we had that communication to be conveyed through intelligence channels and through the military attache channel.
Mm-hmm. What was it like,
so,
the difference between being in Tehran and knowing who your counterparts were, and being in Saigon and, I suppose, not knowing who your counterparts were?
Who cares? In Tehran, in Saigon, you're running programs.
Okay.
Yeah, you're going to have to run it. Ted Shackley was in the Berlin base, part of the German station. Bill Harvey was a base chief. Bill Harvey went out in 65.
Okay. He's a fascinating person, Bill Harvey.
Yeah, well, he sort of went off his rocker. I mean, when he pulled a .45 on the ambassador in Rome, that was basically the end of his career in the elevator of the embassy. He always carried a .45 with him. Loaded, I mean.
I heard he slept with it on him when he would come back from his three martini lunches and would fall asleep at his desk and
Shackley,
put it next to his head.
Shackley was Bill Harvey's deputy in the base. Now, what Shackley's connection with the Tunnel of Love was, I'm not sure. And as I stopped to reflect on it, I'm not sure he had any connection at all.
Well, it's what it comes up in is just
that... They have coexisted with it or something.
You know, that...
But a fellow by name of Alan Conway was the principal officer in the German base, in Berlin base, for the Tunnel of Love.
Alan Conway, okay.
And he later came down to, in 1963, he came down to Tehran as chief of station.
Boy, Tehran really was the...
Tehran was a big base.
And
Tehran was a big operation.
Yeah.
It was right up there on the Soviet border. It's one of the few direct access, direct... Mm-hmm. Soviet border in the world. I mean, Turkey, Iran, and Finland are the only three.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of them were all big belt of satellites.
Yeah. Because you've got the Himalayas, probably can't get over them.
And the Hindu Kush, of course. Then you wind up in Xinjiang and China and all that. I mean, you know.
Well,
what are you going to do about that? It's really one of the amazing things in this world to show you how paranoid the Soviets are. You go up on the northeast frontier in Iran, and here you've got this dry riverbed. It's about 500 feet deep. It's this ravine cut through the desert there.
Mm-hmm.
And I say desert, I mean desert. I mean, it's flat.
Mm-hmm.
And there are mountains here and there. But you see these camels shimmering in the mirage out there, you know, 5 miles away. It's that kind of flat.
Yeah.
And also that kind of hot, I mean. And you get up to the Soviet border, and down the valley of the ravine, there are some greenery and trees and this and that, and that's it. But there across the border, there's the standard, it's almost like it's prescribed in the field manual. Three belts of barbed wire fences and electrified wires, and helicopters and light planes patrol this thing up and down all day long. And there was a regimental armored regiment stationed. There were several armored regiments stationed on the Soviet side of the border, various villages over there. And you wonder, what in the hell for? Who are they either keeping out or keeping in? Because for 1,000 miles on the other side, mm-hmm. it's pure desert.
Going back up into
going
Russia.
Going back into Russia.
Yeah. They're not there as a possible offensive force. No, are they to go into Iran?
No, they're there. They're there just to secure the border. They patrol the border regularly. And just amazing. And you suddenly realize, you know, you're dealing with a different breed of cat here.
Yeah, what a mentality. What a waste of money yeah. and resources
money,
and
resources,
human skill.
Else.
Yeah, it's just a
well,
phenomenal.
Anyway, let's see, where were we?
Okay, let's all right, field operations had three programs.
Yeah, those are the field operation programs.
And they were developed by Tucker Guglielmin?
Oh, no, they're developed by a group of officers over time. And
were there other major participants in these field operations?
Yeah, Tucker really didn't develop anything.
Okay. I'd like to hear some of your feelings or
Tucker
impressions.
Tucker was a great guy, but Tucker was an ex-Marine. Okay. With a shaved bullet head, one wooden leg, and as foul a mouth as you ever come down the pike, and just one of the nicest guys in the world. Mm-hmm. And with all of his Marine background and with his language and everything else, he was the softest touch that you could imagine.
Really?
And ultimately it got him killed.
I understand that he was actually married to Tuan's sister. Tuan being the
married, living with. I mean, okay. You know, that was never very clear.
Okay, but it was her that he went back to get.
He went back to get her and the children.
Okay. And that was Ho Chow Tuan's sister.
I have no idea what her name was. Okay. I mean, I've met her.
Okay.
I've had tea with her and all that.
Okay.
Met the children, but that's...
Well, the reason that I'm interested is that I believe that her brother, Ho Chow Tuan, was the national commander of the Pru in Vietnam. That her brother was... The Pru, I take it, were not a...
They were part of your covert action paramilitary elements.
Okay.
Now, actually, the Pru was a late development.
Okay.
We had pacification teams. Now over on the covert action side now we're talking.
Yeah.
Not the FI side.
Okay.
The covert action teams, village construction teams. These were people who worked out in the villages to try to teach them how to defend themselves and to how to do a variety of things. Political development.
Yeah.
We're very strong on trying to develop grassroots political emergency in the country, and Vietnam is very, very suitable for this approach. Then they had the so-called counter-terror teams. I don't know where you're finding that.
It's something I want to get into more. I know what they did.
Yeah, well, basically the PRUs, the Province Reconnaissance Units,
an outgrowth of the counterterrorism.
Outgrowth and a sterilization, if you will.
Okay.
Cleaning up the name of the counterterror units.
If not the methods.
Now, hopefully the methods. The counterterror unit was units mm-hmm. originally were intended to do to the VC what they were doing to us.
Yeah.
And that meant to get in there and assassinate their village chiefs, or their hamlet chiefs, and their tax collectors. Whatever, leave propaganda behind, and if the occasion arises, to bring back prisoners, which they never want. They also go out, and it's very much like the military people. As the military people would learn, and as it would evolve, nighttime ambushes, and so on. Some of our guys working with these CT units were real nuts, too. There was one man that had to be sent home because he was putting blackface on and going out just about every night. He was very close to another breakdown.
That wouldn't happen to, you mean the Pru counter, a Pru advisor?
That's a CT.
Yeah, CT advisor.
Yeah. No, it's not an advisor. The CT units were unilateral American operations.
Okay.
We hired these people, we trained them, we ran them. And the same way with the PRUs. Those were unilateral American operations. They had nothing to do with the Vietnamese police or the Vietnamese military. Or the Vietnamese whatever. The Vietnamese had counterpart units.
Mm-hmm.
But the South Vietnamese did.
Yeah.
But these were unilateral American operations. As were the Prus.
Okay.
Some of these other things were joint with the and when they set up the revolutionary development programs in late 65, it would be. It was an attempt to integrate and to clean up these various activities.
Okay.
It was in late 65, as a matter of fact, that the CTs became the PRUs.
Okay.
Now, I was offered the PRUs at that time, and I didn't want them. It's probably a mistake. I've developed a slogan in government service: never be objective or fair, because all you do is screw yourself.
What's the alternative?
The alternative is that you look out for number one, and that'll take the hindmost.
Okay.
And that's what most people do. But see, let's take a budgetary matter, for example.
Okay.
Everybody says, okay, austerity program. So you go in there and you sincerely cut your budget, you know, really to the bare bones, and you reduce personnel, and you're really operating lean and hungry.
Okay.
And then they come around with a 10% budget cut 6 months later, and you take the same 10% that everybody else takes, and you're out of business, because all you've done is cut your own throat.
Okay.
See what I mean?
I understand perfectly what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah, okay. When you're fair and objective, if I had been interested in power and so forth, I would have taken those CT units.
Yeah.
So forth. I didn't want them, mainly because I didn't think we could handle them. We couldn't manage them properly. In any event, when they were renamed as Province Reconnaissance Units, their mission was changed from assassination to sabotage.
Really?
To capture. And return. If we could get a VC district level cadre or province level cadre, if we could catch one of those in a hut some night, we don't want him dead. And this is the difference between your police mentality or your terrorist mentality versus your military, police or military mentality versus the intelligence mentality. The intelligence guy wants that guy back to question him, to interrogate him.
Yep.
The policeman wants to put him on trial and put him in jail. Never hear of them again.
Okay. So Pru becomes intelligence.
Pru becomes intelligence.
Okay.
Rather than terrorism.
Do you think that was something that was actually affected?
To a degree. Not entirely. Okay. Not 100%. But
that was the idea.
John Hart was not a guy to kid around with. If he told them to clean up their act, they cleaned up their act.
Somebody told me that John Hart was called heartless by some of the people that worked for him.
John Hart was he's no egomaniac, but a little bit more under control than some of the bad ones. He was a smart one.
What does he look like physically?
Well, a big imposing guy, about 6'2", very regal bearing. Almost British accent.
Okay.
When he came out of the station, I was one of the guys. One of my activities as chief of field operation, mm-hmm. I was traveling up and down the provinces all the time.
I bet. Yeah.
And among other things, for example, twice I flew blind into situations. On assignment from chief station to investigate into civil war situations, and we didn't even know whether we even had.
Because you must have been there during the Buddhist uprising.
I was there. I went into. I flew into Da Nang blind in the Buddhist uprising.
Okay. Oh, that must have been fun.
Flew into. Well, fun is not the word for it, but it was exciting. Yes. Flew into Da Lat when Da Lat was supposed to have been taken by the VC after the Buddhist insurrection on a different occasion.
What was that like?
And, well, scary. You go down there with a loaded machine gun, submachine gun in your arm.
And where do you go? What do you do?
You get out there and you hope that there's somebody to meet you in a Jeep.
Uh-huh.
And as a matter of fact, in both cases, there were.
Military people or?
No, they were our people. Okay. Turned out. And in both cases, the situation was not nearly as bad as all the rumor factory down in Saigon had going. That's which of course, is the reason for an on-the-spot investigation in the first place.
Yeah.
Because nobody can really make sense of all this chaotic information coming in.
Yeah.
So they send somebody up there to make the gas boom off and tries to get out of there.
Because that's where the snipers are set up. They're waiting for the planes to come in so they could pick somebody off.
That's right. Exactly. And Chu Lai was a great place for that kind of thing. But when John Hart came out as chief of station, this is just a personal anecdote here.
No, that's fine.
He had me, I was one of his escort officers, to take him on a tour of the whole country and to visit the facilities, explain what was going on. So, and my job was in question at this moment because Hart had another guy slated for CFO. And one of his guys,
okay,
who was coming out from Washington. And so, among other things, we got into the discussion of local cuisine and mag food, and there's always a great division in the foreign service world between those people who get out on the local economy and try to eat native and find out what's going on versus the people that hole up in the American colony, so-called golden ghetto people. Most of your military dependents in Germany, for example, they've never heard a word of German spoken. They've been on base here. These girls sit in their homes there and watch TV, and American TV, and go down.
They don't want to know from anything else.
They don't want to know from anything else. Well, yep. They're golden ghetto denizens, is what they are. And so anyway, we were talking about Vietnamese food and Chinese food and this and that, versus the guys that go down into the MAG, Military Advisory Group, the MAG compound for dinner every night. And John Hart made the remark, and as I say, he was sort of an egomaniac. He viewed himself as a latter-day soldier of fortune also. And local economy speaks fluent French and was always trying every occasion he could to impress people with his French. And he made sort of a sneer-like remark to me one of the evenings we were having dinner. He said, "Oh, really? I would have figured you for the kind of person to go to eat dinner in the MAG compound every night." And so in my own mind, I said, "Oh, boy, that takes care of that. I mean, that,
I'm gone.
So I'm going. that job is down the drain." Well, John Hart later found out, A, that was not true, and B, that he was persuaded to point me to that position. So all's well, it ends well, and that ended well. But I had a bad couple of days over that one.
Yeah. So it sounds like you liked your job, you liked doing what you were doing.
Oh, yes.
You found your job, despite the danger.
Don't forget 50% hazard pay.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay.
50%. Had bought a house for us back in the States. Put that in parentheses.
Okay.
And don't let it show up. That's off the record.
Oh, okay. Oh, no, it sounds like a legitimate... I mean, people have to think of their family. I mean, if you have two children, maybe more. But by that, did you have more than two eventually?
Well, no, I divorced and remarried in the meantime with a single daughter in the second marriage.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah.
But, there's no... There's nothing secret about people needing to earn a living.
The fact of the matter is what we did. That the Vietnam assignment carried with it a 50% premium pay.
Okay.
And that made a big difference.
So how was your working relation with Hart after that?
The working relation with Hart, with John Hart, became excellent.
It did, okay.
And I respected him. And even though I started out with a base of insecurity, I learned that he respected me. And later on, as it became quite evident, because here we get to the Phoenix business.
Okay.
That in the fall of 1966, there began this big reorganization, trying to clean up the Revolutionary Development Programs and clean up the Act and streamline the war effort and this and that. So they reorganized the station into the RDC unit, which took over the paramilitary activities of the station, the so-called revolutionary development activities of the station, propaganda, indoctrination, political education, political grassroots development out in the villages and hamlets, took over all that for one branch and took over the field operations, police field operations for the other branch. Now, there's always a big fight in the agency as to how covert the agency should be and how